Thank you. The microphone is a device for distorting the human voice, and this is not a very large room. Imagine that it is about 1,000 years ago, somewhere in Europe, and you are one of a line of 10,000 men with spears facing that way. And the reason you're doing it is that coming at you from that direction are another 10,000 men with spears on horseback. And you do a very quick cost-benefit calculation. You say, if all of us stand, and if we plant our spears and hold them solidly, with luck we can break their charge. And if we do, some of us will die, but most of us will live. If we run, horses run faster than we do. So I should stand. I'm sorry, I made a mistake. I said we. I don't control him and him. With 10,000 men, whether I run has very, very little effect on whether we stop their charge. If everybody stands and I run, I won't be one of the ones who gets killed. And if everybody runs, I'd better be running, otherwise I'm certain to die. Everybody makes this calculation. We all run, and most of us die. Welcome to the dark side of rationality. This is an example of what I think of as market failure. I believe it's a mistake to think of market failure as being specifically about ordinary economic markets. That market failure describes a situation that occurs in many different contexts where individual rationality does not lead to group rationality, which is what I've just described. Let me give you the modern version of it. We're going to now fast forward to somewhere around World War II, and you're a soldier in a foxhole, and what you're supposed to be doing is to watching for enemies and shooting them. And of course, doing this is quite likely to get you killed. So what you do instead is to keep your head down, shoot random shots in the right direction. With luck, that keeps the enemy's heads down, and at least your officer won't know that you're not aiming. The rough estimates for the U.S. Army in World War II is that the ratio of bullets fired to enemies killed was roughly 20,000. All right, that's a fairly striking fact, and I think illustrates why the standard picture of how warfare goes is wrong. Let me now describe exactly the same logic in an even more modern situation. The theory of our democratic system, what I think of as civics class democracy, is that the reason it works is that if politicians don't do good things, we vote them out. In order for that to work, the voters have to know what the politician is doing and whether it's good. Knowing what any particular politician is doing is quite a lot of work. You have to actually follow them, figure out how he voted, on which issue, and why. And for some reason, politicians almost never campaign on the theme, I'm the bad guy. As far as I know, nobody has ever introduced a bill into Congress with the title, a bill to make farmers richer and city folks poorer. Although, in fact, such a bill has been introduced essentially every year for, about the last 80 years, roughly. All right. So that means that in order to make this model work, the individual voter has to spend a lot of time and effort being well-informed about what's happening, about what policies are good or bad, and so forth. What's the payoff for doing that? Well, there are a few people whose hobby is politics the way other people's hobby is baseball, and so they follow politics the way other people follow batting averages. But if your objective is simply to improve the world, it's pretty easy to see that in a presidential election, the chance that your vote will be decisive is somewhere between 1 in a million and 1 in 10 million, much less than that in some states, actually. It would depend on the state. And if there is a benefit from getting a better person, you share that benefit with 300 million fellow citizens of your country. Your share is fairly small. So if you ask, does it make more sense to spend that time and energy doing my job better or educating my kids or reading a good book, or to spend it trying to figure out who to vote for, I think the answer is pretty obvious. And this explains why, in practice, most Americans, in fact, are rationally ignorant. Rationally ignorant because the cost of the information to them is greater than the benefit to them. So that's the modern version of the same thing. And as I say, all of them ought to be covered by the general term market failure. Whether it's market failure in the political market, market failure on the battlefield, market failure in a firm putting out pollution, those are all logically the same thing. And they all come from situations where you have a decentralized system where the individual actors are not receiving the net benefit of their action. All right? The ideal decentralized system is set up so that you get the benefit of what you do and pay the cost. Or at least, if you get $10 less than the benefit, you pay $10 less than the cost. This is pecuniary externalities for people who are familiar with the term. But if you don't have that condition, then the decentralized system will work less well than would a centralized system with a perfectly wise ruler, which happened to be in short supply, so it's not really an alternative. But you can see that where individuals bear a very small part of the cost of their action or receive a very small part of the benefit, they are unlikely to find it in their interest to take the right action. I thought it might help if I used slides. See, that was supposed to, yeah, sorry, that's the button I wanted. Just to summarize what each of my sets of stories is about. And this is a story about the public good problem or about market failure more generally. Let me now tell you a puzzle I'm fond of, which illustrates something related to market failure. Two Bedouins are riding their camels through the desert with the oasis a mile or two away. And one of them starts commenting about what a terrible camel he has. This beast of mine, this snail masquerading as a camel, has got to be the slowest beast in all the deserts of Arabia. And the other Bedouin says, "You think your camel is slow? Let me tell you about my camel." And they get into an argument about whose camel is slower. And eventually they agree on a bet that whichever one's camel reaches the oasis last, his owner will pay a golden dinar to the other one for the best. That's showing it's the slower camel. And so you can imagine what happens. One of them goes slowly, and the other goes more slowly. They're both trying to win the bet. And an hour later, there are two Bedouins sitting their camels stock still in the blazing sun in the middle of the Arabian desert with the oasis still a mile away. And at this point, a wise man comes walking along, and he says, "Why are you two idiots sitting your camels in the middle of the desert like this?" And they get off the camels to explain the problem. And he whispers two words to them, and they leap back on the camels and ride off to the oasis as fast as ever they can. Can anybody who hasn't heard this before tell me what the two words are? Switch camels. Each one is riding the other's camel, and you've now reversed the incentives. Now let me tell you another story, which I don't have as good an answer to. Jose robs a bank in Texas and flees south across the Rio Grande with the Texas Rangers in hot pursuit. And they catch him in a little town in Old Mexico, only to discover that Jose speaks no English and none of them speak any Spanish. So they draft the local schoolmaster as a translator. And the Rangers say to the schoolmaster, "Ask Jose where he has hidden the money." The gringos want to know where you've hidden the money. "Tell the gringos I will never tell them." Jose says he will never tell you. The Rangers pull out their six guns, cock them, point them at Jose's head. "Tell Jose that if he does not tell us, we will kill him." The gringos say, "If you do not tell them, they will kill you." Jose begins to tremble with fear. "I buried it by the tree at the end of the bridge." Jose says he is not afraid to die. All right, that's a problem in incentive compatibility. All right, you want systems which are incentive compatible. In the first case, we solved the problem. It was incentive incompatible to start with, but switching it made it compatible. In the second case, it's not clear what the solution is. Presumably, if the school teacher has figured it out right, the Rangers kill Jose, they search, they don't find the money, they go away, and he digs it up, which is obviously his plan. So that raises the question of engineering incentives. How can you change a system so that you go from having inefficient incentives to having efficient incentives? And the camel joke is sort of my favorite really simple example of that. But there are a lot of others. I'm currently working on a book on legal systems very different from ours. And one of the many systems I'm looking at is the legal system of Periclean Athens, which I like to describe as the work of a mad economist. It's full of clever ideas that might or might not work. And one of them is their solution to the problem of producing public goods. And the Athenian solution to that problem was that if you were one of the richest Athenians, every other year you had to pay for producing a public good. So the relevant magistrate comes up to you and he says, you've heard that we're sending a team to the Olympics this year. Congratulations, you're the sponsor. Look at that beautiful trireme down by the deck. You and another guy, because triremes are expensive, you're paying her bills this year. There were two ways of getting out of it. One of them was to show that you had already done one of these things this year or last year. The other was to show that there was another Athenian who hadn't done it last year, wasn't doing it this year, and was richer than you are. And the question is, how in a society without accountants, without IRS, without banks, how do I prove that you are richer than I am? And it's an economist's answer, which is why I like the story. Any guesses? I offer to trade everything I own for everything you own, and if you turn me down, you have admitted you're richer than I am. Like most clever ideas, it's got potential problems, but it's nonetheless a really lovely idea if you think about it. Let me give you another one, and this is a story I got from Ami Glaser, who at least used to teach economics at University of California, Irvine, where I visited for a quarter a long time ago. Ami wants to buy a used car. So he goes to a used car dealer, he finds a car he likes, and he says, I'm interested in this car. If I pay you some extra, will you give me a one-year warranty on it? And the dealer says no. And he goes on, and after a while, he eventually finds a car he likes where the dealer says, yep, extra $500, I'll give you a one-year warranty. All right, says Ami, I want the car, I don't want the warranty. All right. Ami's a clever guy. I think he's also the one who had an elegant solution for the problem of deciding whether to permit mergers. And that is that when someone applies for a merger, if the other companies in the industry oppose it, you permit it. And if the other companies in the industry support it, you don't permit it. And I will let you think about the logics of imperfect competition as to why that's... Of course, it only works until people find out you're doing that, but it's still a clever idea. Let me describe another problem of this sort that all of you as teachers have faced. And that's what I think of as the silent student problem. That you explain some idea that you think is perfectly clear, and you've explained it perfectly clearly. You say, now, did everybody follow that? And nobody says anything. And so you go on, and only when you grade the midterm do you discover your mistake. And if you think about it, this is logical behavior. That the individual student who doesn't understand it says to himself, first, if I say I don't understand it when maybe the other ones do, I'll look stupid. And even if a professor isn't explicitly grading for that, he's less likely to give me a good grade if I seem to be stupid. And I'll look stupid to the other students, and I care about how they feel, so I'll keep my mouth shut. And I have a solution to this problem. It's a technological solution, and I admit I'm only a theorist. I haven't implemented it. But the solution goes as follows. You arrange your classroom so that every seat on the floor there is a button that can be unobtrusively pushed with somebody's toe. And there is a screen at the back of the classroom which shows the number of buttons that are being pushed. And so at the critical point, you say, well, everybody who understood my explanation of comparative advantage, please push your button. And the number 2 appears on the screen, and you go back and do it again. So that's the case of trying to alter the incentives by allowing an anonymous report in a way that hopefully leads to something better. Let me give you another example from our profession. Imagine you're a student, and you've gotten to the point where the only questions left on the exam are ones you don't know the answer to, and you still have 10 minutes left. What's the obvious thing to do? To bluff. You write something, and you maybe your handwriting is deliberately a little bit messy, so the reader, the professor will see what he wants to see, and if you're lucky, you'll get some credit on it, because he'll think maybe this guy knows something. And this is wasting your time. It's wasting the professor's time who's going to grade it, and it's raising the errors in evaluating students, both because you might get credit for something you don't understand and because the professor might think somebody is doing this when he's actually writing unclearly but does understand the idea. So you'd like to get a way to get students not to do this. And I have a very simple solution. I start with the story of why why Socrates was the wisest man in Athens. The oracle told him he was the wisest man in Athens, and he was puzzled by that because he didn't know anything. And then he came back to Athens and talked to people for a while, and he concluded that the oracle was right. No one else knew anything either, but they thought they did. So in my class, on my exams, you get credit for knowing that you don't know something. The standard rule I give is that any question you leave blank or write I don't know, you get 20%. And that way, unless you think you know more than 20%, because you can get less than 20% if you write an answer, all right? So unless you think you know more than 20%, it is in your rational self-interest to leave it blank. And that saves me some time and trouble, and it saves them some time and trouble. So that's another example. And I want finally to discuss a case related to this, which actually occurred to me. And I wrote a price theory textbook a very long time ago. And many years later, I decided to try rewriting that book as a book aimed at the intelligent layman. That my model was the selfish gene, if any of you have read it, which is a very good book on evolutionary biology that you read for the fun of it. And that's how my Hidden Order got written. And it occurred to me when I was writing Hidden Order that because this was written for the intelligent layman, not for college students, nobody was going to be forced to read this book. And that meant that if at any point in the book the reader decided that it wasn't worth reading anymore, he would stop, unlike a student who's assigned something. So I deliberately tried to design that book so that every chapter started with a hook, started with some puzzle, some question, some interesting idea, which would get resolved by the end of the chapter and would therefore keep the student reading. And if you think about the incentives in producing textbooks, the incentive in producing a textbook is not either to write a book that will do a good job of educating someone or that will be entertaining to read. It's to write a book that professors will assign. And that's a rather perverse incentive since the professor's interest is not identical to the student's interest. So that's a yet another example of the problem that I think of as engineering incentives. Let me now go on to another bit of economics that I think you can explain with good stories. And I want to start with a puzzle that's actually in my price theory textbook and that I'm still rather fond of. And so I thought I'd put all of it up here so you could read it. I don't know why it's gray. It shouldn't be, but that was my mistake. You're a hero with a broken sword. Conan, Boromir, or your favorite Dungeons and Dragons character. Being chased by a troop of bad guys, bandits, orcs. Fortunately, you are on a horse and they are not. Unfortunately, your horse is tired and they will eventually run you down. Fortunately, you have a bow. Unfortunately, you have only 10 arrows. Fortunately, being a hero, you never miss. Unfortunately, there are 40 bad guys. The bad guys are strung out behind you as shown. There was actually a picture in the book. Use economics to get away. Any suggestions? How do you use economics to get away? First you shoot the bad guy in front, then you shoot the bad guy in front, then you shoot the bad guy in front, then they all run slowly. All right? So the critical point here is that you can't impose a high enough average cost to discourage them, because they're still coming and they know you're a hero, but you can impose a high enough marginal cost. Now let me tell you a real story, at least one. I don't know that it's a real story, but it's out of the 13th century account, and it may well be real. And it happened at the Battle of Clontarf, which was a battle in Ireland between a Viking army led by Sigurd, the Jarl of the Orkney Islands, with some Irish allies, and an Irish army commanded by the High King of Ireland, Brian Boru. And this one, I actually have a poem somebody wrote which tells the story, and I like it, so I will impose it on you. Sigurd, the Jarl of the Orkney Isles, has called to his banner a Viking band and sailed to Dublin to make himself king of the Irish land. But crowns are never so quickly won, the Norns they know. The king of the Irish blocks our way. We must to battle go. The raven banner of the Orkney Jarl brings luck in battle, but the bearer dies. Two men have fallen neath its wings today, but still the raven flies. The Jarl tells a third man to take it up. The third man answers, no. The devil is your own. Take it up yourself and back to battle go. 'Tis fitting the beggar should bear the bag, replied the Jarl, and I'll do so here. He fought with the banner tied round his waist and fell to an Irish spear. He fell, and the Irish broke our ranks. We had no choice but flight. But I'm not hurried. It's a long way home. I won't get there tonight. And the tale is out of Njálssaga, which was written in the 13th century. The actual battle happened about 1014, and you can see the logic of it, that they believed that there was a spell on the banner, such that as long as it was carried, the army would advance, but whoever carried it would die. And I like this not just because it makes the marginal versus average point, but because one of the responses you sometimes get in arguing economics is, well, maybe modern people are sort of cold-blooded cost-benefit evaluators, but not those other people. Well, Vikings are sort of our prototypical heroic warriors. And according at least to a story that the Norse themselves told and presumably believed, in a whole army of heroic Vikings, three men, counting the Jarl, were willing to die in order to get victory. All right, so it's a good story, and I think quite a useful story from that standpoint. But then to apply the same principles in a somewhat more recent example, think about how you set up a tax that doesn't collect any money. What do you do? It's very simple. You say, well, rich people don't really need their money. So let's look at where the 90th percentile of the income distribution is, say $150,000. 100% tax on everything above that. Well, you're not going to collect much money, because once you've set that up, very quickly you will discover that nobody earns more than $150,000, at least in visible taxable income. Well, all right, 90th percentile has gone down a little bit. Now we set it at $130,000. Follow out the logic, and you end up with a 90th percentile at zero and a tax revenue at zero. All right? So the logic is exactly the same as the superhero problem. First, you shoot the dollar in front. Then you shoot the dollar in front, then you shoot the dollar in front, then they all run slowly. So it's a neat way, I think, of showing how the same economic logic applies across a wide range of human behavior, which is what economics is ultimately about. Let me push my button. That's what that one is more or less about. Let me go on to another interesting question. And this is one which I get into because I teach economic analysis of law. And the way I like to put it is, what's wrong with stealing anyway? That after all, economists are supposed to be objective social scientists. We're not preachers. We don't believe in right and wrong, at least professionally speaking. We believe in things like economic efficiency. So you steal $100 from me, I'm $100 worse off, you're $100 better off. Isn't that a wash from the standpoint of economic efficiency? And the answer is that the logic of markets applies to illegal markets as well. And if you can easily get $100 by stealing from people, people enter the stealing business. As more and more people become thieves, the return to being a thief goes down because your victims are more likely to conceal their money. You're more likely to pick somebody's pocket and find that another competitor has gotten there 5 minutes earlier and the pocket's empty. In a variety of different ways, it's not quite the same mechanism by which increasing the number of economists drives down the wages of economists. But the basic logic of it is the same. Increasing the number of thieves drives down the return to being a thief. When does the process stop? The process stops when the marginal thief can make just about as much stealing as he could make working at McDonald's or whatever his alternative position is. Well, at that point, in the limiting case where all thieves were identical, so they were all marginal thieves, the entire amount stolen would be dissipated by the diversion of labor out of productive activity into stealing. In the real world, there are going to be some inframarginal thieves, some people who are very bad at putting hamburgers or very good at stealing. They'll make a positive return. But on the other hand, there are additional costs paid by the potential victims in trying not to be victims, and those have to go into the net cost as well. So the net cost could easily be more than the amount stolen. It could be less, but it's not zero. And that's, from an economist standpoint, the reason ultimately that we're against that. Let me now tell you a somewhat bigger story of this sort. This is due to Terry Anderson and D.J. Hill, for those of you who aren't familiar with their work. And they argue that the Homesteading Act, under which large parts of the U.S. became private property, was the largest mistake the U.S. government has ever made, since it, by the same logic I've just described, wiped out the land value of the U.S. All right? Think about the situation. There is a piece of land beyond the effective frontier of settlement, and if you go and farm there now, you'll lose $5,000 a year because there are no markets, there are no railroads, there are probably no roads, there are hostile Indians, various things of that sort. On the other hand, as the frontier moves out, in another 10 years, the loss goes to zero. Another 10 years, you just break even farming it, and it then goes up from there. Whoever farms that land for 8 years or whatever the length of time is in the Homesteading Act owns the land. So you say, well, let's wait until the point at which it just covers its cost and go out there, and what do you discover? You discover, of course, that someone is already there because someone else can do the arithmetic, and he can say owning the land as of 1900, say, which is when it becomes worth farming, gives me a present value of $300,000. After all, the amount I'm getting is going up and up over the years. I'm willing to lose a little bit of money. I'm willing to come a year early and lose a few thousand dollars in order to get a property right that's worth $300,000. But if you come a year early, you have the same problem because someone else did the same calculation and came 2 years early. And if you run through the logic of that, this, of course, is rent-seeking, if you run through the logic of that situation, you see that the land will get settled early enough so that the amount that you lose in premature farming just balances the amount that you eventually get from the value of the land. That was the Hill and Anderson argument. Now, I actually have a sequel to that story because I got interested in it and I read up on the literature of the conversion of land to private property. And, of course, Anderson and Hill's solution was they should have auctioned the land off. And then the same amount of money, instead of being spent trying to farm prematurely, would have gone to reduce taxes or to pay for the government doing something or something of that sort. The problem is that they had tried that method. That, in fact, the Homesteading Act is about 1860-something. And prior to that, there were attempts to auction off the public lands. What happens? They announced that a particular land in the far west, probably almost as far west as we are now, is going to be opened up for settlement. And you are the representative of a consortium of entrepreneurs in Boston, and you go out to pick some good land to bid on. And you find that the process for allocating the land is being held in a local courthouse, and the local courthouse is full of rough, tough frontiersmen with guns leaning up against the wall and Bowie knives in their boots. And they explain to you very politely that around here, stranger, people don't bid against a settler for his land. Because, in fact, the land has been illegally settled in advance. All the best parts are already taken. And it would be very risky for you to bid for pieces of land which, legally speaking, are unowned, but in fact are owned. So that was what happened. When that doesn't work, the settlers are, after all, voters. And so they try to persuade Congress that even though we agree in principle this auction is a fine idea, we are brave settlers out on the frontier, so you should let each man buy his bit of land in advance of the real auction for a nominal price. So in fact, there were real problems in auctioning off a resource, an inhomogeneous resource belonging to a political institution, which may help to explain why homesteading worked the way it did. Let me go on to let me press the button. That's rent-seeking, which you presumably all already have heard about in other contexts. Let me go on to another example I like to give of application of economics. And this is to imagine that you're in the supermarket with an armful of groceries, and the question is, which line do you go to? Should you walk along checking out each line to find the shortest one, or should you go into the closest one? And the general answer is you go into the closest one, because they're all the same length. Why are they all the same length? Because if one of them was shorter, somebody who came in between that and the longer line would divert to the shorter line, and that would bring it back up to the same length. So the first approximation, you can go on to more complicated situations, to corner solutions and transaction costs. No, but the first approximation is that you can expect all the lines to be the same length. And therefore, since it's costly to you to go searching with your armful of groceries, you go into the nearest lane. Let's apply the same logic on the highway. And I'm sure you've all had some version of this experience. You're driving along on a rather busy highway, and you say, you know, the lane to my left is moving a bit faster. I'll switch over. And 5 minutes later, you notice that red pickup truck that was just behind you when you switched over is now just about parallel to you. It's a very funny thing. You'd think that just by switching into the faster lane. But, of course, the logic is, again, the same. Anytime one lane is moving faster, there is an incentive for people to switch into that lane. That slows it down. So you again get the same principle, which can be generalized as everything is equal at the margin. All right. And again, it's only at the margin. You can imagine special cases. There are circumstances in which there's a reason why one lane is faster or slower. It's about to turn or something. But as a general rule, which reminds me of a different story which has to do with engineering incentives. This was a friend of mine a long time ago who said that she never took dents out of her car because having a dented car made the other drivers more careful. But of course, as you realize, I've just explained to you the efficient markets hypothesis, that that's the sort of formal, fancier version of the same story I'm telling you, which is that if, with publicly available information, you can easily predict that a particular stock is going to be worth more than it is, it won't be. That is, it will come up as soon as that information is available, because people will buy underpriced stocks. And note, to bring it to something that's even more relevant to your students than the efficient markets hypothesis, that the same logic applies to jobs. That you shouldn't say, well, engineers make more money than lawyers. If they do, I don't know if they do, so I'll be an engineer. You should say, there are always people who can choose among these things. Their movements will tend to equalize the return. If engineers make more money, either it's harder to become an engineer, or it's riskier, or they work harder, or they get less social status, or you don't know what it is, but that you ought to expect that your first approximation is that all the options available to you and many other people are equally attractive. And you then want to figure out where you're inframarginal. Figure out where you, compared to the other people making the decision, are better at A or worse at B, and therefore make your choice accordingly. So as a way of thinking about the real-world choices your students face, I think starting with the equal marginal principle as your first approximation is a whole lot better than starting with, all I've got to do is to look at wages, and that'll tell me, which is what people are inclined, I think, too often to do. I think it is late enough that I'm going to skip two things, which we can come back to if we have more time, which have to do basically with the marriage market, which is a lot of fun, and talk about this point, which I shouldn't really have put up there because I usually put them up after I finish telling the stories. And I want to start with one of my very small collection of economics jokes. And this is one I got from the editor of Price Theory, Dennis Hansman, Southwestern Publishing, a long, long time ago. An economist and a businessman are walking in the woods when they come across a large and hungry bear. And the economist turns to run. And the businessman says, "Don't be stupid, you can't outrun a bear." "No, but I might outrun you." All right. And that is demonstrating a general point, which is that someone, or in this case a bear, wants to do something that will hurt you. The reason isn't that he wants to hurt you. The reason is he wants to accomplish something. He's hungry. So the question is, how can you arrange that the best way of accomplishing what he wants to accomplish doesn't hurt you? Now let me tell you two more stories along these lines. Consider the question of what happens if private citizens carry handguns, which, as you probably know, is a politically loaded issue. Concealed carry is the technical term for it. An ex-student of mine did an article on it a long time ago, which has gotten him into quite a lot of trouble and conflict and so forth. And it's tempting to say that, after all, criminals are professionals. So in a fight between a mugger and a victim, the mugger will usually win, with or without guns. That's probably true, but that's not the decisive thing. Imagine that one little old lady out of 10 carries a pistol in her purse. And imagine that when a mugger tries to mug a little old lady, 9 times out of 10 she drops the pistol or shoots herself in the foot. And 1 time out of 10 she kills the mugger. All right. She's losing on average. But little old ladies rarely carry enough money to be worth 1 chance in 100 of getting killed. So what you have done is to make mugging not impossible but unprofitable. And my favorite explanation of this idea is actually a science fiction story. It's a story by Poole Anderson, which is in my very short list of works of literature that can be used to teach economics. And the story is called Margin of Profit. And it is set in a future where there's interstellar transport. And the protagonist is Nicholas von Rhen, who is the head of Solar Spice and Liquors, which is a big interstellar trading firm. And the problem is that there is a small and rather unpleasant empire, which is sitting right on top of a trade route that they want to follow from one planet to another. And this, Borthu it's called. And Borthu is in the habit of piracy, of seizing passing ships, brainwashing their crew in some high-tech fashion to join it to their navy, and adding the ship to their navy. And the question is, what to be done about it? And so von Rhein consults with his peers, with the heads of the other major trading firms, and it's pretty clear that Borthu is not a very large state. The trading firms are pretty rich. If they were willing to put enough money into it, they could fight a war with Borthu and defeat them. But that would cost more money than all the profits on that trading route are ever going to be worth, so they're not going to do that. And so von Rhein gets the others to agree that if one of them solves the problem, the others will give him a bonus out of their return from the trade route. He then sets up a policy of arming, they consider arming their merchant ships. But by the time you arm a merchant ship, you've reduced the amount it can carry, you've raised its cost, it no longer makes money. So what von Rhein does is to arm one ship out of five. The merchant ships have small crews, Borthu's warships have large crews. So four times out of five, Borthu gets a merchant ship and impresses four members of its crew. And one time out of five, the merchant ship gets the Borthu ship and seizes a crew of 100. On average, Borthu is losing by their activity. And as von Rhein explains to his fellows, not being stupid heads, they will realize this and stop attacking us, and then maybe we can do business. So it's really quite a neat story, which again, the basic point is the same point, that the objective is not to make what your opponent is doing impossible. Borthu could keep doing it, just isn't profitable anymore. And therefore, not being stupid heads, they will stop. I like Will Anderson. He's very good. All right, next one has to do with Dr. Strangelove. Dr. Strangelove, as you probably know, comes out of the idea of a doomsday machine. And the idea of a doomsday machine, which I think Herman Kahn thought up, was that in order not to have to maintain a big military, what the U.S. does is to build a whole bunch of very dirty hydrogen bombs, so dirty that if they all go off, they will sterilize life on Earth. And we don't need a delivery system. We bury them in the Rocky Mountains. They then have a trigger which will set them off if the Soviets ever launch a nuclear attack on the U.S. We tell the Soviets about this. The Soviets now know that if they attack us, the world will end, so they don't attack us. And, of course, Kahn was suggesting it not as a serious proposal, but as a sort of a simplified version of what we'd really done. That is to say, mutually assured destruction was a human-triggered strategy which amounted to saying, it's true it won't do us any good to shoot back at you after you wipe us out, but we'll do it anyway, therefore don't wipe us out. All right? Same logic. There is, I should say that as the story is usually told, it's not incentive compatible. One point I don't think Kahn ever noticed is, suppose you're the last engineer out of the cave where they've got the bomb. What's the last thing you do on your way out? You cut the wire. Because the only time those get triggered, you don't want them triggered. All right? But putting aside that point, it is a nice way of formalizing the idea of a commitment strategy. And the place where I got into this was a talk at UCLA when I was there, where somebody was explaining why deterrence didn't work for crimes of passion. And he tells a story in which two guys sit down at a bar and get into an argument over sports teams. And the argument gets louder and louder, and when it's over, one of them is dead on the floor, and the other is standing there with a broken beer bottle in his hand and a dazed expression on his face saying, what have I done? And the guy said, that clearly can't be deterred. He regrets it as soon as he's done it. And I, as best I remember it, I got up at one end of the room, and Earl Thompson got up at the other end of the room. He said, of course it's rational behavior. It's just a doomsday machine going off. That is to say, imagine that you're a big, tough guy who likes getting his own way, as most of us do, and you can commit yourself into being an aggressive personality, into being a bully. So you make it clear to those around you that if people cross you, you beat them up. People, and crossing you gets wider, a wider and wider expansion that, you know, dating the girl you're trying to date is crossing you. And actually having to beat people up, you might get hurt, but as long as you've got a good enough reputation, most people back down because they don't want to get hurt. And it works just fine until one day you sit down in a bar and there's a big tough guy and you start explaining to him why your football team is much better than any other football teams, and he's got the nerve to disagree with you. And by the time it's over, one of you is dead on the floor, and the other is standing there with a broken beer bottle in his hand. So you can think of that quarrel as the human equivalent of a doomsday machine. The man, each of them has programmed himself to a commitment strategy that if you cross me, I'm willing to be violent. And it pays most of the time until you run into somebody else with the same strategy. And as it happens, the evolutionary biologists have invented a term for this problem. They call it the hawk-dove game. And in their version, hawks and doves are identical birds except for their behavior. When two birds see a piece of food and both head for it, doves back down and hawks fight. A fight on average costs you more than the food, but as long as most of the other birds are doves, you usually win. And if you work through the math of it, you can see that if you raise the cost of a fight, the equilibrium number of hawks goes down. That in equilibrium, the number of hawks and doves adjusts until the payoff of both strategies is the same. Similarly, in the bar yard, in the barroom brawl story, if you punish the guy who did the killing, that means that the benefit of that strategy is lower than it was before, and that means the equilibrium number of bullies is lower. All right. So in fact, you can deter crimes of passion. I should say Earl Thompson is the person who taught me about commitment strategies a long time ago. He sort of persuaded me that they were one interesting way of thinking about the world, one of the things that was going on. He's no longer alive, unfortunately. But and I got into a discussion on my blog. It turned out that the same student who wrote the piece on concealed carry that I mentioned, the same ex-student of mine, had also been a friend of Earl's. He was a graduate student when Earl was a professor at UCLA, as was I, and was also an admirer of his, said he'd gotten a lot of his education arguing with Earl. And I thought that was rather neat, because both I and my students are fairly extreme libertarians. Earl was an ingenious, if unconventional, left-winger. But he was a good economist. He was a smart guy. He was fun to argue with. And that was much more important than whether he agreed with either of us, and we both had that same reaction, which I liked. Let me say a little bit now, more generally, about the approaches that I've been trying to illustrate. One of them is that you want the kind of good story that will get people's attention, like the camels in the desert story, or the armies running away. Somewhere, I think, in either Price Theory or Hidden Order, I comment that when psychologists want their audience to listen, they talk about sex. Economists talk about the income distribution. But sex works, too. And one of the chunks I didn't go through was explaining the problems with a barter market as the explanation for why so many people are frustrated. Because if you think about the marriage, dating, sex market, unlike most markets we're on, that's necessarily a barter market. Because if I'm sleeping with you, you're sleeping with me. Therefore, what you have to do on that market is to find someone you want who wants you. And that's much harder than ordinary markets where you can find one person who wants what you're selling and another person who's selling what you want. And putting it that way, it seems to me, gets the students' attention, and at the same time, it gets them to think about the advantages of money over barter, which are two alternative ways of doing the same thing. A lot of people think of economics as sort of being about money and being boring. And so part of what you want to do is to show applications such as the ones I've been showing where the logic of economics is being applied outside of what we usually call the economy, where you're looking at armies running away, why marriages are less stable than they were 200 years ago, which is basically because there is less relationship-specific sunk cost in a marriage, which comes out of the fact that we have much greater division of labor and household production and much lower infant mortality. I go through those arguments in my books if you're curious. So you would like your story to be one people will remember and ideally even repeat. That probably the story of mine that's got most coverage is the explanation of how you can grow automobiles. And the story is that we've got two technologies in producing automobiles. We can build them in Detroit or we can grow them in Iowa. And how do you grow automobiles in Iowa? You grow the raw material automobiles are made out of, which is called wheat. You load it on a ship. You send the ship into the Pacific, and it comes back with Hondas on it. And that's the technology for producing automobiles. And that's an important point, because what that tells you is that a auto tariff is not protecting American workers from Japanese workers. It's protecting American workers from American farmers. It's essentially a way of taxing one of two alternative technologies for production in order to favor the less efficient technology. So that's a useful point. I discovered sometime in the last year or two that I was an unintentional plagiarist, that same argument in a much longer and a more elaborate form was made in print by someone else long before I made it. And I looked at his version, and my version is a paragraph or two, and his version is, I think, a couple of pages. And his is a long story where a man announces that he's made a great invention for producing things, but he's got to keep it secret. And he sets up his factory with all sorts of security barriers on the coast. And he buys inputs and he sells high quality, low cost outputs of various consumer goods. He's a hero. Everybody says, isn't this a wonderful example of American progress, until someone sneaks in and discovers that all he's doing is exporting and importing, and now he's seen as a swindler. But the point is, I think his is a better story. His is a longer and more detailed story. But mine is much easier for people to remember and repeat, with the result that mine has spread and I only discovered his when somebody happened to point me at it. Economics jokes. That's right. Let me briefly give you my short list of economics jokes. I've already told you two of them. The first one is two economists who walk by a Porsche showroom, and one of them says, "I really want that car," and the other one says, "Obviously not." After all, he walked by it. The next one is one that I actually got out of a Middle Eastern cookbook, and that is, what is sweeter than honey? Free vinegar. Thinking about ratio of value to cost rather than some absolute standard of value. And then there's one that I got in The Joys of Yiddish, which is also an economics joke. Leo Rosten in The Joys of Yiddish defines a frosk as a flap. He's giving Yiddish words and explaining the English and giving. It's really a book about immigrant Ashkenazi culture in New York in the early 20th century, but it's in the form of words and explanations. My father was so mad yesterday, said little Morris, that five separate times he wanted to give me a frosk. How do you know it was exactly five times? Because I counted. What did you count? The number of times he hit me. I thought you said he wanted to hit you. Would he have hit me if he hadn't wanted to? That's an economist joke. Another thing you want to look at is, you want stories that get attention, and we remember that they teach lessons, that they're useful to people, such as how to think about choosing a profession, why not to be fooled by people who say you can make lots of money investing in fuel oil. After all, winter's coming, so fuel oil prices have to go up, right? So forth and so on. And one final point is that one of the real difficulties in teaching economics, as you people probably have already discovered, is your students think they already know it. That economics seems to be about the world they're living in, things they're familiar with. It uses words whose meaning they think they know, like efficiency or competition. And therefore, it's very tempting to listen with half an ear on the grounds that the professor is just droning on in some detail about things you already understand, and only discover when the exam gets graded that you're wrong. And so it's quite useful, if you can do it, to find things where the economics gives them the opposite of what they think is true. So let me give you one of my examples, and that's the question of, what is the effect on men and women of legalizing polygyny? Polygyny is one man with multiple wives. Polygamy covers both polygyny and polyandry. So suppose it becomes legal for one man to marry more than one wife. And the natural instinct of people is to say, well, that's good for the men, they get multiple wives, bad for the women, they got to share a husband. But if you think about it a little bit more, you say, that doesn't work. It's not like there's an infinite supply of wives out there to be grabbed. There's a market out there. What have we just done? We have increased the demand curve for wives, because whereas before, one man could only bid for one wife, bid in a market where you're offering your characteristics and implicit terms of the marriage contract and so forth. Now, everybody can bid for one wife, but some people can bid for two. Well, if you just run through supply and demand curves, you shift that demand curve and the price goes up. So what's happening now is that in order for a man to get a second wife, he ought to offer her terms attractive enough so she prefers being his second wife to being the first wife of whoever was her alternative suitor. And not clear whether it benefits men. That it's true that men who want two wives can now get them, but they're getting them at a higher price. And all the men with one wife are now worse off because they've got to offer her more favorable terms in marriage. You can think of it as a market with implicit terms. It's not a perfect model because of problems in enforcing contracts and things, which you could get into. But it's a good enough model to suggest why the economics suggest exactly the opposite of what people think the result. Another example along similar lines, which again I do in Law and Econ, is imagine you want to help poor people, and you say, well, poor people live in slums, and some of those slums, the apartments don't have hot water. So we'll make a law saying it's illegal to rent out an apartment that doesn't have hot water. And that sounds like it's going to help the poor. You think about it as an economist and say, wait a minute, the poor person could have paid a higher rent for an apartment with hot water. The landlord would have been happy to rent to him at a higher rent. Furthermore, let's think about what those numbers are. There is some sum which represents the cost to the landlord providing hot water. If that sum is less than the amount at which the poor tenant values hot water, it will be in their mutual interest to agree to include in terms of what's being sold the hot water, just like we include four wheels on a car when we sell it. If it isn't, if you then look at how the demand and supply curves shift when you change the characteristic of the good to make it more expensive to produce and more valuable, it's pretty easy to show that the shift will result in raising rents by an amount more than the value to the tenant and less than the cost to the landlord. So that what looks like a choice that benefits one group at the expense of another, in fact, hurts both groups. So that's another example, but the more general point really is that you want to think about cases where what seems obvious to them isn't true, because that you may not convince them, but at least I have to think about it in that case. And of course, the final example you're probably all familiar with is the question of who pays for Social Security. That everybody knows, that not many people know, that Social Security is paid half by the employee and half by the employer. Every economist knows that this is window dressing, that this doesn't matter. Because what you're really saying is that when my employer gives me some money, he has there is a difference between what I get and what he pays. It doesn't matter whether that dollar bill is handed over by him just before he pays it to the government or by me just after. In either case, the difference is the same. In either case, the equilibrium wages are going to be the before and after tax wages are being the same. It's pretty easy to demonstrate, as you probably know. Who really pays, you don't know. That was going to depend on elasticity of supply and demand. But the basic point is seeing that who pays in that sense is pure window dressing, which I think most people are not going to realize. All right, I wasn't sure I could get through all of this in the time I had appointed, but I think I have. So why don't we now have discussion and questions and things.
Do you have any questions? I'm related to two PhD physicists at the University of Chicago, one who is quite older than either of us, whose ideas sound so familiar, it's like being back at home. And I had a dad who was a union member, and he was a libertarian. He didn't like people interfering with him getting his beer, so he had made his bathtub gin. He resented all these laws, and there's the, you know, libertarians just don't, so you're scary.
All right. I don't mind.
Any other questions?
Oh, by the way, our brother was a theoretical physicist, and his advisor was just one of the local hospitals.
Where was he, at Chicago or somewhere else?
University of Chicago.
Yeah, I good. No. Right, yeah. So who was his advisor?
Dan Booth.
Aha, uh-huh. Right. I think he was there when I was there. But mine was there in that.
All right. We're going to retire from here to a reception. Pam? Where is the reception? Right here. And it just so happens that I have three copies that have been ordered. that I'm inclined to auction off to the highest bidder. Professor Friedman will be here to sign. Some of you already have copies. And I'll be here to take pictures of you getting your signed copy with Professor Friedman. And the reception is in the back of the room.